It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, as Russia's Vladimir Putin moves to annex Crimea, Syria's Bashar al-Assad forges ahead with his scorched earth campaign to crush his opponents, whom he characterizes as terrorists, even if they are moderate opposition or innocent civilians and children. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. This month marks the third anniversary since the start of the conflict, and Syria has become the world's leading country of forced displacement. More than 40% of all Syrians have fled their homes. More than 2.5 million have registered as refugees in neighboring countries. And the political and humanitarian crisis in Syria shows no signs of abating. The so-called Geneva II peace talks ended in a stalemate. The murderous regime of Bashar al-Assad is gaining the upper hand, bolstered by arms from Russia and Iranian-backed Hezbollah troops from Lebanon. Meantime, the West has not provided the type and magnitude of military support to Syrian opposition forces necessary to deter Assad. Washington and other European capitals have been fearful of engaging in yet another Middle East conflict and have been fearful that sophisticated arms could fall into the hands of al-Qaeda-linked militants who have infiltrated the divided opposition. In recent days, Washington has named Daniel Rubenstein as the new envoy for Syria, succeeding Ambassador Robert Ford. The United States has ordered Damascus to suspend the operations of Syria's embassy in Washington and consulates in other cities, but the move stops short of a formal break in relations. For more on diplomatic and military options for bringing the carnage in Syria to an end, and whether Western pressure on Moscow over the crisis in Ukraine will seriously complicate those efforts, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Andrew Tabler is a senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he focuses on Syria and U.S. policy in the Levant. He is also the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. And Valerie Sabala. She's a research analyst at the Institute for the Study of War. That's a policy group also based in Washington. She focuses on the conflict in Syria. And Valerie was in Damascus studying Arabic when the uprising began in 2011. And Valerie joins me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Andrew Tabler joins us from his office at the Washington Institute. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
Well, Andrew, I would like to begin with you, and I'd just like to read a very short paragraph from the New York Times last week by Anne Barnard, which I think pretty much describes the situation. She goes, "Day after day, the Syrian civil war has ground down a cultural and political center of the Middle East, turning it into a stage for disaster and cruelty on a nearly incomprehensible scale. Families are brutalized by their government and by jihadists claiming to be their saviors, as nearly half of Syrians, many of them children, have been driven from their homes. And at the start of the fourth year since Syrians rose up in a peaceful movement that turned to arms after violent repression, a snapshot of the country presents the harsh truth that Syria's descent is only accelerating with nothing to check it." So here we are, Andrew Tabler. We had the Geneva so-called peace conference ending in a stalemate. Either side can't even agree on the interpretation of the document. In Geneva, one side, of course, the U.S., the West, and the opposition saying that Assad has to go and there has to be a transition. And, of course, Assad, Russia, and Iran saying, not so fast. So they disagree even on the premise. Where do we go from here?
It's really hard to tell, sadly. After 3 years of protests and conflict, both sides have been driven to extremes. The regime and its brutality and using conventional and non-conventional weapons such as poison gas, Scud missiles, and so on, has absolutely brought out the worst in the opposition, who's been fighting back, begging for international intervention, and has plunged the country, as Anne's article depicts, into the abyss. The real problem that we have in front of us isn't just the humanitarian disaster. That is well over 140,000 killed, almost half the Syrian population of 22, 23 million displaced. but there's just no end in sight to the conflict, no international agreement on what the parameters of a settlement would look like, and no agreement in the region between the two backers, Iran on the side of the Assad regime, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states on the side of the opposition. So I'm afraid 2014 could be even more grim than 2013, and that's really saying something.
Let me get Valerie Sabala to weigh in. No question it's a humanitarian disaster, but as Andrew Tabler suggests, it's a strategic disaster as well for the region. We have really at hand a proxy war between Assad, his regime, and his Iranian and Russian backers on the one hand, and of course the Sunni Gulf states trying to repel and resist Iranian aggression. So where do you see things going?
Like Andrew, it's very hard to say. The proxy war has been evident for a long time, and unfortunately, the lack of real hard action on our part or on the part of the West has further empowered and enabled Russian and Iranian action in the conflict. And they've both, I think, strengthened their positions in the region strategically. So that's going to make it harder as things move forward for any real solution to occur.
Back to you, Andrew Tabler, back to the so-called Geneva process. The way we hear Assad talking in Russia, it seems as if that's really not going anywhere anymore. He's talking about, that is, Bashar al-Assad holding elections, almost surreal thinking
right.
When you think about it in a country that's racked by war. Is there any hope, or is this process pretty much dead?
The Geneva process is dead. It doesn't mean that some kind of diplomatic process is impossible. The magic number here is 97. Most Americans woke up this week and found that 97% of Crimeans had supposedly voted to join Russia, a strong backer of the Assad regime. 97 is also a magic number in Syria. 97.62% was the percentage that supposedly voted for Bashar in the last Syrian presidential referendum, which I witnessed in Syria. You know, Syrian elections are a joke. They're the butt of jokes in the Arab world. They're the most manipulated, if not the most manipulated, in the region. And what makes this particularly ironic for Syrians is that after all this conflict, this is the solution that Bashar al-Assad is holding out: contested elections for president under his leadership. And, of course, the reason why that's a problem is that it makes it extremely unlikely that you could fold the opposition into that election cycle. You could perhaps bandwagon some of them into it, but it's not going to lead to a real settlement in the country. And I think that is the big problem at the moment, because a lack of a settlement, a real settlement, means that the country couldn't remain divided for some time. And in this case, legally, when Bashar wins re-election, it would be for another seven-year term as president.
And Valerie Sabala, in terms of the process in Geneva, would you also agree that it's dead, or do you see any kind of diplomatic process on the horizon, given the situation, the tensions between the United States and Russia over Ukraine, and the situation on the ground in Syria?
No, I think Geneva's dead. I kind of think it was always a little bit farcical based on a read of the parties involved. I'd like to also comment on the elections. I'm not sure everyone in the U.S. and abroad understands how sham these elections are or will be, because we hear the word elections and we think democracy. So not even the historical record of these elections having one candidate that you have to vote for, pretty much a rubber stamp. But recently the regime has taken legal actions to make them even more unwinnable by anyone other than Assad. We saw a headline a couple days ago or weeks ago saying that the regime legalized other candidates, but they also pretty much prevented every opposition member from running in the elections. They're reissuing ID cards. They closed embassies of countries that have refugees so Syrians can't vote. I mean, they're really taking great lengths to ensure there's no chance.
Back to you, Andrew Tabler. With respect to the Ukraine crisis, Russia, of course, is warning that Western pressure on Moscow over Ukraine could jeopardize cooperation on a number of international issues where its cooperation is needed, such as Iran, nuclear talks, North Korea, and, of course, Syria. How do you anticipate these mounting tensions between Moscow and Washington will affect diplomacy over Syria?
In terms of a transition, what we were aiming for, echoing what Valerie just said, I think the cooperation on that is dead. It was never really there anyway. There are actually documents leaked supposedly by the Syrian government outlining how Russia told them how to obstruct the Geneva talks. On some other issues, though, the cooperation continues. On the chemical weapons front, around 45.6% of Syria's chemical agents have left the country. But the compliance is coming very late, and they thus far have refused, including an interview in the Wall Street Journal, to destroy all of their 12 declared weapon sites. They want them for civilian use, which, again, these are the words of the Syrian deputy foreign minister. It's farcical because, of course, you wouldn't use military sites, former chemical weapon sites, for civilian purposes because they're toxic. And not only that, but destruction of the sites is required under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which the Syrians have supposedly signed. So we have partial cooperation on the chemical weapons front, and that can cause everyone in the region, as well as President Obama, who has hitched a lot of his policy in Syria, to the Chemical Weapons Convention. It can cause him a lot of problems.
Valerie Sabal, anything to add or subtract with regard to the impact of this crisis over Ukraine between, of course, Moscow and the United States? And I would probably agree with Andrew that some might argue that Moscow has not been that helpful anyway.
I think that the best interest of the regime, and Russia has assisted in this with chemical weapons, is actually to stall, and that's been a big part of their plan, is drag it out. I think that you should interpret it through that lens when you see things like them not wanting to destroy 12 sites. This is going to delay the process as they debate this. If anything, I think that by Russia kind of unmasking itself in Crimea, where there are reporters who can report out and see what's really happening on the ground, since Geneva also, we've seen increased movement for the U.S. kind of reconciling with Saudi Arabia and maybe taking some stronger action. Closing the embassy is long overdue, that kind of thing. So in that sense, maybe some positive change will occur on our end.
Back to you, Andrew Tabler. You have a pulse to the ground with regard to the military situation, the state of play, the balance of power between Bashar al-Assad and his allies from Hezbollah and the opposition. Talk about the balance of power on the ground and the divisions, of course, which unfortunately do exist within the opposition.
It's a big subject, and Valerie works a lot on this as well. The opposition is divided into hundreds of different groups, and it depends on how you cut it. Syrian oppositionists oftentimes join multiple groups at the same time, and some of their formations are umbrella organizations. In the overall fight against the Assad regime, they have recently suffered setbacks in the Qalamun region, which is the Syrian-Lebanese border region around the anti-Lebanon mountain range, some areas around Homs, and also in the north part of the country towards Aleppo. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that Bashar al-Assad is about ready to retake all of Syrian territory, and I think he's far from it. There are large swaths of the country that are controlled by the opposition, including many extremist groups, which have cropped up. And his ability to hold those areas remains in question. It would be hard to know. He's been able to go on the offensive with the help of Hezbollah and other Shia groups. It would be harder to hold those areas, Sunni-dominated areas in the north and the west. In any case, we're in for a very bloody year as the regime tries to consolidate at least its hold in the west and in the north. And given the lack of diplomatic and progress otherwise, I think that could be said to continue for the coming years as well.
Back to you, Valerie Sabala. I'd like you to discuss the current balance of power, to what extent Assad is gaining strength, especially because he does have the backing of Hezbollah and lots of arms from Russia, and talk especially about the opposition and how it is divided between the so-called moderates, who actually were at the forefront of the uprising, many who defected from the Syrian army, and unfortunately the infiltration of Sunni extremist groups, Al-Qaeda-linked, ISIS, the Al-Nusra Front. How much influence do these extremist groups have or exert vis-a-vis the more moderate opposition that the West would like to support?
I think that we have a tendency when we see a specific victory on the ground to jump in that direction and say, oh, the regime is winning because they just had a series of victories in Yabrud, in the Qalamun area. And they definitely have taken advantage of a number of key factors, such as the winter, I think was a big help to them in their sieges where they starved people basically into submission. They've also took advantage of rebel fighting with the formerly Al-Qaeda-linked ISIS in the north to make gains around Aleppo. But like Andrew said, it doesn't mean they're ready for a victory. Particularly, you know, there are signs that the U.S. and Saudi Arabian support has increased to rebels in the south who are making slow gains, and I think that's something we need to look for. Regarding the division of the opposition, it's always been divided. It's tough. It's a big country. This sprung up all over the country. Communication in the field there is incredibly difficult, more or less. You can talk about coordination at a military level, and a lot of the changes that we see in the realignments of brigades all the time has to do with funding. If you put yourself in the position of a fighter on the ground and you don't have any ammo to shoot back at tanks, and there's a unit over there who are fighting for the same goal, they may ultimately want something different than you, but right now they're overthrowing Assad and they can offer you guns and all the things you need to fight, then that is a lot of times why people join these Islamic groups who are getting a lot of funding from the Gulf. Not all of it stayed. the majority of it is actually through private donors going to the more extremist groups.
Indeed, making it much more difficult to coordinate.
Very much so.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Andrew Tabler. He's senior fellow in the Program for Arab Politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Valerie Sabala, from whom you just heard. She's a research analyst at the Institute for the Study of War. And we're talking about the devastating civil war in Syria and diplomatic and military options for bringing the carnage to an end. And here's a big shout-out to loyal listener Ida İpek from Turkey. Teşekkürler. Thank you for your feedback. If you want to hear your name on the show and hear me say thank you in your native language, send me an email with comments and feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Well, back to you, Andrew Tabler. If, in fact, we're at a stalemate now and we don't see any diplomatic solutions in the offing, what is the West, what is the United States, the European allies, what are they thinking, again, with the backdrop of this crisis with Russia over Ukraine? Are there any efforts to try to bolster the moderate opposition? Some of new commanders have come to the fore who seem to be fighting the militant groups in Syria. They're fighting ISIS, they're fighting and trying to establish their credibility. What are your thoughts and what do you know about that?
There have been multiple efforts to try and deal with moderate opposition groups in Syria in terms of training, in terms of providing weapons. And this is mostly through a covert program, but also through our allies as well in the region. The moderate rebels historically have suffered from a couple of problems. One is lack of effectiveness on the ground. The Supreme Military Council, which was the darling of the West and the United States, recently reorganized, is again another umbrella organization where you have multiple groups under one umbrella. It's hard to coordinate those groups. And some of those groups that were within that umbrella structure were not funded. In the meantime, things shifted towards the right, towards the far end of the Islamist spectrum. And now you have many Salafist groups in particular, which are closer to the extremist al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, which means that funneling assistance into Syria, as some had projected earlier, and particularly around the time of threatened strike against the Assad regime, is more difficult because any kind of military assistance could fall into the hands of extremists, and that would be not only a political problem for anybody who recommended that or carried that out, it would be a huge problem in a security sense because some of those groups threaten U.S. targets and U.S. interests. They might not right now, and I don't think that they largely do, but they could in the future. They could threaten European targets, and it's hard to mitigate that downside risk in the current situation.
Valerie Sabala, how do you see efforts by the West, by the United States in particular, against this backdrop of tensions, especially with Moscow, in terms of stepping up any kind of military support? Is that, as Andrew said, there are many efforts, but is it enough? Is it wise, given the possibility that some of the weapons could indeed fall into some extremist hands? And by doing so, the West is basically picking a war, in a sense, with Moscow and Iran, just at the time that the West is trying to conduct delicate negotiations over Iran's nuclear program.
Personally, I do think it's wise. I understand very serious risks, but I feel like the cost of inaction, and we've seen this over 3 years, is much more risky. I took a trip down memory lane yesterday and was reading some articles from early on in the conflict about the rebels, and the same solutions that were proposed then are what we need to do now. It's sad that we haven't realized it, but at that time, you know, these armed groups trying to overthrow a really cruel regime said, we need weapons. We can't fight without weapons, and we would love a no-fly zone. They're killing us from the air, and that's exactly the same kind of thing that we still need to do to make any difference. I know that the constant refrain, and at this point, I think it's a red herring argument that people just say because they don't want to get involved in anything, but what if these weapons fall into the hands of al-Qaeda? The fact is, al-Qaeda already has a lot of weapons in Syria. This is not our biggest concern. I think that the costs of not doing so are worse than the possibility that they might get an additional weapon. And by enabling the moderate brigades, by strengthening them, you might be able to turn people back in that direction. And that's exactly what we want to do.
Back to you, Andrew Tabler. Back when things were perhaps easier to deal with, many were saying, well, we need to peel off some people in Assad's circle, more moderate-leaning types, perhaps not his family members, but what chance of that is there now, or have the sectarian tensions become so hardened between the Alawites and the Sunni and, of course, the Christian community, many of whom feel more comfortable perhaps with Assad because he has always said that he would protect them? Again, he's saying this sort of like a brainwashing because he wants to stay in power. But are we past that point where reconciliation is possible?
It's hard to tell. This is going to be a very long conflict in one way, shape, or form. I think that people in the regime are cowering around Bashar because they've been encouraged to do so by Iran and by Russia in trying to hold this together. It's also become the sectarian nature of the fight has also driven them together. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's forever. There's one rule about the Assad regime in terms of the peeling off process. That is, no one ever leaves the Assad regime unless it's in a coffin. And I think that's, in the end, how this is going to shake out. Now, the question is, who leaves in a coffin? If it's Assad who leaves in a coffin, that is either by his own people, through a decapitation strike or whatever, then you have a hope of getting what's left to come together with more moderate elements and reunite the country in the not-too-distant future, hopefully. If it's only Assad that remains, I think it's harder, given the sectarian nature of the conflict, to reunite the different parts of Syria. So what we're staring in the face at the moment is the specter of partition. And partition is not just a de jure problem, like, you know, a legal problem that people have to deal with as the former Yugoslavia or Somalia. It's the security threats that come out of these areas that are nominally part of Syrian territory but are not controlled by any one central authority with any kind of responsibility. And that has security threats on its own. The Assad regime also has reconstituted itself in its own areas, so it's no longer the regime that I lived under for so long, that Valerie studied under. It's now a constellation of forces, its own military, own security services, Iranian forces, Hezbollah, and other Shia militias. And these two Shia-Sunni forces fight against each other and grind down into the nature of Syrian society. And that is, I think, horrific and dangerous at the same time.
And to compound the problem, Valerie Sabala, we have a regime that uses starvation as a weapon of war, drops barrel bombs on civilians indiscriminately, or perhaps even with great intent. These are acts tantamount to war crimes, which a recent UN report has been documenting. Do you see any possibility for any kind of reconciliation that could get past these sectarian divides that have been hardened in a country which at one time was very multicultural, where Sunni, Shia, or rather Alawites and Christians and Jews actually were living quite relatively harmoniously?
I do. I mean, you have to be optimistic. You look at other examples around the world of difficult wars. Time moves on. I know my slice of Syria is small, the window through which I see it, the direct contacts on the ground, but I've asked all of my contacts there how they feel about Alawi or Sunni or whatever sect they're not, and the majority of Syrians, I believe, are quite moderate. We don't see them in the news. We see the loonies on both sides, the technical term there. We see the regime and the sectarian tensions they're trying to stoke with Hezbollah and Shia militias. And you see the al-Qaeda elements. And these are the guys who make the headlines. But that's not all of Syria.
Back to you, Andrew. Now, I want to ask what I call a historical if. Here's the question. What could the United States and its allies have done to bolster the rebel opposition when it was a peaceful uprising that was trying to defend itself from Assad's brutal attacks and crackdown? Would military strikes on strategic Syrian targets, both before and after we had evidence that Assad used chemical weapons against his own people, have escalated the war in your view, as some argue, jeopardizing our relations with Assad's allies, Russia and Iran? Or do you think the United States and its allies could possibly have altered the trajectory of the war, putting Assad sort of on the defensive and putting him on notice that our deeds, in fact, do match our rhetoric, and perhaps bolstered the opposition, giving them a chance to gain strategic leverage either at the negotiating table or an advantage on the military field?
I think following through on our enforcement of the red line President Obama outlined in actually August of 2012, and finally Assad went over decisively in August of 2013, would have significantly damaged the regime, yes, militarily, politically, and otherwise. Could we have guaranteed a victory for the rebels? No, we couldn't have, but we could have pushed it towards the settlement, I think, that many would have liked to have seen, and that is the one that was being negotiated in Geneva. Instead, we've had the opposite. Now, of course, this is crystal ball gazing. Things didn't happen that way. And there are consequences to not following through on that strike. And I think what we see now is the Assad regime is putting through what I call the forced solution, and that is grinding down and trying to pummel the opposition into submission, and also using local ceasefires to accomplish that, and pinning a transition in Syria to Assad's re-election. I just don't see that as a viable settlement to put the pieces of the country back together. It's also a terrible defeat, I think, for the opposition if it's successful. But there's a lot of innings still to be played, I think, in this struggle. I don't think that anyone is going to be giving up in Syria anytime soon, and particularly the regional parties. Unfortunately, the Iranians and the Gulf Arab countries are very happy to fight each other to the last dead Syrian. And that is, I think, a sad reality. And hopefully things change and push things in a better direction. But the problem is at the top from the White House. And it has been for some time, including what they call in the government the non-strike incident. We have a big problem in Syria in terms of the humanitarian disaster. And I think that concerns people because of the cost, the human suffering, and the overall resentment that it will generate. But the destruction of Syria and the spillover effect into neighboring countries like Lebanon and Iraq, at least so far, also threatens the regional, what they call the security architecture, the post-World War I boundaries there. And the United States is heavily invested in those countries, and many are right to predict that it will set off conflicts that will be much harder for us to deal with, will threaten our allies, and over time make us less secure. And I think that, combined with the threat of terrorism that generates out of that, is the primary concern of a lot of people trying to grapple with this issue here in D.C.
Let me put the same question to you, Valerie Sabala. What could have been done, perhaps, to have changed the trajectory of this horrific conflict?
I think it would have made a huge difference had we done targeted strikes from afar. No one, American or Syrian, is suggesting ever putting U.S. boots in combat in Syria, but had we done standoff strikes against targets to disable part of the regime's military machine, it would have been hugely helpful for the opposition, who, quite frankly, we had told that we were going to do so, and they had prepared themselves militarily to take advantage. So not only was it a huge mental and emotional blow for the rebels that thought they were finally going to get some help, but it was also a strategic blow where positions they might have left undefended in order to take full advantage of a strike against the Assad regime. I think we missed a huge opportunity, and it's time to wake up.
That's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrew Tabler, he's senior fellow in the Program for Arab Politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Valerie Sabala, research analyst at the Institute for the Study of War. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Audrius Regas. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.